Will I have me a job down at the local mill? Work right up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
Hello, folks, and welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Happy New Year, everybody. I guess this will be our New Year show, and we're going to maybe touch on some stuff that's happened in the previous year, as well as we have a special guest calling in at about half past the hour, an activist and organizer from the AFSCME Union named Fran Tobin, who was involved in a campaign a few years ago to stop the state of Illinois from hiring a corporate entity called Maximus to basically privatize the Medicaid system here in the state of Illinois, and specifically to focus on disqualifying people for Medicaid. And they were able to prevent that. The ironic part of that story is that they said it was going to save the taxpayers money, when in fact this contract with Maximus Corporation was going to cost twice as much almost as it would have to have state workers do things, you know, as far as not disqualify people, but just to service Medicaid recipients.
Yes, but Dave, you know that private company will be much more innovative and efficient.
Sure they will.
And that's how that they can do it cheaper.
Oh, sure
they even will. Though they are taking some kind of a profit off of it, markup.
And even though it costs taxpayers, you know, more money, you know, that's the whole thing is, you know, this privatization thing goes back to the early part of the 1900s, when the socialists finally got control by elections of the city of Milwaukee. That's one of the first things they got rid of, was all these privatized outsourced contracts to do street repairs and other things, and had their city workers actually do it. And it was a much better job, and it cost a lot less money. So, but here we are. We're in the era of privatization, attack of corporate America, trying to rob and pillage the public sector, attempts to privatize schools, privatize prisons, privatize healthcare, which they've already have, and of course, you know, the Affordable Care Act just you know, expanded and consolidated that. But anyway, we want to also let you know that the views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. And anyway, I guess we've got some underwriting announcements at some point, but why don't I go ahead and do a news story while Bill's you know, getting ready for that. This is from Mexico. I guess yesterday, three police officers were wounded on yesterday in the southwestern Mexican state of Oaxaca after clashes with protesters who had gathered outside a rally headlined by Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. The president was on hand to launch his so-called reform agenda, which is really an attack on public education, an attempt to privatize it, for a new year, including new privatization of energy projects. The protesters were organized by the Teachers Union, the National Syndicate of Education Workers, hurling rocks at anti-riot police and burning tires. The protesters came out to voice their opposition to Peña Nieto's attacks on public education from 3 years back that took power away from Mexico's Teachers Union, in addition to legislation aimed at opening up the energy sector to privatization. But the protesters voiced their frustration over a wide net of problems in Mexico, including the high-profile case of 43 missing apprentice teachers in the neighboring Mexican state of Guerrero. More than 3 months after the students disappeared, and with tensions still high in Mexico, investigators are still souring swaths of the rest of state of Guerrero in search of the missing. Some 15 mass graves have been uncovered so far, but only one missing student has been identified amongst the remains. Following months of violent protests across Mexico over the tragedy, a New Year's Eve vigil in Mexico City was a largely peaceful affair. And you know, that's one, I was talking to Bill before the program. You know, we gotta be careful with the terms we use, the words, because they have hidden meanings. I mean, they're subtle. For instance, whenever they talk about in the corporate media, and I even see this sometime in the so-called liberal progressive media, that they use the terminology of the corporate media, which we've got to get away from here. For instance, when they say reform agenda, what they're talking about is a privatization agenda. It has nothing to do with reform. And anyway, I was waiting. I thought Bill had a
question. Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Dave. Well, I do have one thing. We were also talking about some racial issues and also, you know, basically terminology.
Yes.
And definitions. And I'm looking at a picture of Enrique Peña Nieto here, the president of Mexico. And I tell you what, this dude don't look anything like the people I work with from the Mexicans I work with. This dude looks like he's from Sweden or France or somewhere.
Well, because he's 100%
Spanish. He's not Mexican. Yes. He's Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Know? Most Mexican people are primarily, Native American.
Right.
You know, Aztec or Mayan, with some Spanish mixed in. I mean, Northern Mexico, the people tend to be more, mixed with, Native American and, Spanish. Farther south into Mexico you go, of course, the more Native American it becomes, especially in Southern Mexico where the, most of the people there are, either 100% or close to 100%, Mayan Indian.
Oh yeah, man. I was hoping, I can't find how tall this guy is either.
Well, that's because the other thing. People of, yeah, Spanish, heritage, mostly Spanish heritage that are Mexican tend to be taller too.
Oh yeah. And you're talking about Mayans. I remember when there was some, I think there were, I'm not sure if they were Mockley workers. Mm-hmm. This is like 6-7 years ago around town, about McDonald's, Chipotle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean it, these dudes, they don't look anything like, the people in that, old Gibson, Road Warrior dude. Mel Gibson, he made that movie, Apocalypto. I said, what, Illuminato or something? Yeah, Mel Gibson, they don't look anything like that, man.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
See, and here's the thing, and this is bad. I'm a fairly short person. I'm 5'6" tall.
Mm-hmm.
And, a little over a year ago, I had a job, it's the first job I ever had, where I was the tallest person on the crew.
Oh wow.
And that was really weird. And these guys, I think this contractor actually was going down to the border and recruiting people or had people, you know, bringing their relatives up. I mean, these guys, they couldn't hardly, even the boss, it was real difficult to understand him.
Were they getting union wages?
Well, they're in the union and I didn't talk to him about it, but see, this is the contractor that bounced 5 out of 7 paychecks on me. Mm-hmm. And these guys, the contractors, the company owners are Italians.
Okay.
I mean, they even have accents when you call up and bitch at them on the phone.
Okay.
And, I don't know, maybe I focus on these, have been finding this interesting because this last contractor I've been working for, they're out of St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're Italians with a lot of Mexicans working for them too. I did hear that contractor, the other contractor, the really bad one, they had done some work in town the year before, and I talked to a local laborer who had worked for him, and he said that one of their regular guys had told him he hadn't been paid for weeks.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I can just imagine what, you know, they probably have them in some kind of group housing situation in Chicago, you know.
And I wonder if they're not just cooking the books and not paying them union wages.
That's true too. And that's known. I mean, I've heard that about, some companies around here in the past, you know, getting kickbacks from their employees.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bill, some underwriting announcements, whenever you're ready.
Oh yes, sir. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs and Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs and Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. You know, that's the third Saturday at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. And that's like about a block southwest of, Krannert.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And I'm sad to say that those numbers have shrunk since we've been underwritten.
Yes.
For almost 20 years by the AFL-CIO.
Indeed.
Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization, otherwise known as the GEO, at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, strives not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you very much, Bill. We're going to take a quick music break, and we're going to be right back, and we're going to be talking about some public service announcements here that are pretty relevant, and then we're going to be hopefully getting our call from our guest. And in between, Bill and I are going to be talking about a lot of different topics that relate to working people. So stay tuned. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot. Cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack. Just busted concrete and rusted tracks. The empty storefronts around the square. There's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here.
Okay, that was James McMurtry. We can't make it here anymore. And fortunately, that's becoming more and more a reality here in the United States, thanks to all sorts of things, including corporate trade treaties. Speaking of which, two things to look for upcoming here this month. The first month of the first year of 2015, there's two things that are going to be coming up on the horizon. One is going to be there's going to be a massive public relations campaign to try to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You're going to see President Obama out there telling us it's the best thing since sliced bread, and he's going to be joined by Republicans and some corporate Democrats on that.
I'm going to look this up.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, these things are called trade agreements.
Yes.
They are not treaties, because a treaty, I believe, would require 2/3 vote by Congress.
Ah, good point, Bill.
Yep. Now, see, I don't know what the constitutional standard for, on agreements versus treaties mm-hmm. is, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay, good point.
I'm Googling.
Another thing to look for coming up here towards the end of the month, January 29th, there's going to be an election in Greece, and this is going to be a very pivotal election. There's a coalition. I mean, for listeners who aren't aware, Greece has just been hit extremely hard in the last 4 or 5 years by the austerity regime that is imposed on it by the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, and the World Bank. Their standard of living has fallen incredibly. Life expectancy has even fallen. And I mean, Greek people have been fighting back, and they formed it's called Syriza. It's a coalition of various working class parties that came together in a united front, and they almost won the election just a few years ago here. Anyway, I guess there's going to be another election coming the 29th, and polls show that they're actually ahead. So, of course, we know that the banks and the Greek wealthy and the corporate media all over the world is going to be probably doing all sorts of shenanigans, trying to make them look bad, try to sabotage their efforts of trying to get elected. So that's something to watch out for as well. But anyway, I wanted to do some public service announcements here, because we're going to have kind of an interesting program today, and I just want to make sure these get read here. To begin with, tune in today and every Saturday from 2 to 3 for another sports show hosted by a fellow worker, Neil Parthen. That's at 104.5 WRFU. And this Sunday and every Sunday from 3 to 4 p.m. is 9/11 television at Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. And after 9/11 TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 is Labor's Worldview TV. That's all at Urbana Public Television. You can access it online as well at urbanapublictelevision.org. Okay, coming up to the Art Theater Co-op at 126 West Church Street in downtown Champaign this Tuesday and Wednesday. This coming Tuesday and Wednesday, January 6th and 7th at 7:30 p.m. is Citizen 4. This is in January 2000. This documentary of the year may also be its most hair-raising thriller, according to the Globe and Mail of Britain. And anyway, in January 2013, Poitras, recipient of the 2012 MacArthur Genius Fellowship and co-recipient of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, was several years into making a film about surveillance in the post-9/11 era when she started receiving encrypted emails from someone identifying himself as, quote, Citizen 4, who was ready to blow the whistle on the massive covert surveillance program run by the NSA and other intelligence agencies in the United States. In June of 2013, she and Glenn Greenwald flew to Hong Kong for the first of many meetings with the man who turned out to be Edward Snowden. She brought her camera with her. The film that resulted from this series of tense encounters is absolutely genius in the history of cinema, 100% real-life thriller unfolding minute by minute before your eyes. And that's this Tuesday and Wednesday at 7:30 at the Art Theater Co-op in downtown Champaign. There's going to, on the after the Wednesday showing, there's going to be, I guess, a panel discussion on this. So that might be very interesting to check out. Art Theater Co-op's been getting some really interesting films here lately. This is from Healthcare Now. Lessons from the first year of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. The explosive increase in deductibles, copayments, and limited networks is making health insurance less and less meaningful for many people. Over 36% of people polled said that their out-of-pocket spending went up by double-digit percentages. A Gallup poll that has been running for the last decade found that access to health care actually got worse in 2014. This is incredible given the expansion of health insurance to 10 million new people. Some families have seen life-saving improvements under the ACA, particularly those who have chronic illnesses, while simultaneously the ACA is doing real harm to other families by undermining union health care plans, imposing a tax on high premium plans, and cutting safety net payments to hospitals that serve the most vulnerable communities. We need to stand in solidarity with those who are being helped and hurt and acknowledge that this is not a humane or affordable health care system. Please support Healthcare Now as a voice of sanity as we teeter on the brink of entering an era of universal underinsurance. Healthcare Now is a grassroots organization that addresses the health insurance crisis in the U.S. by educating and advocating for the passage of expanded and improved Medicare for All legislation in the form of U.S. House Resolution 676. And related to healthcare, in 2011, Vermonters voted to institute a single-payer healthcare system called Green Mountain Care in the state of Vermont. Now the money is not there to fund it, and the governor is not advocating for the plan, but simply saying it cannot be implemented. Alternative funding, like a special waiver from the Affordable Care Act from the pot of money reserved for expanding Medicaid in states that have refused it, is needed, and a champion in the Vermont state government is needed as well. Progressive Democrats of America is helping organize a massive rally on January 8th at the Vermont State House, and we're trying to contact 13,000 Vermonters who voted for this plan, and we need help from phone callers from all over the country. Anyone wishing to join the team for this important battle in the fight to get single-payer health care should contact Mike Fox at 727-320-4502. That's 727-320-4502. And last but not least, it's the first Saturday of the month, and it's time again for the anti-war demonstration in downtown Champaign, sponsored by the Anti-War and Racism Effort. It's from 2 to 4 p.m. Today at the corner of Main Street and Neal. And you can join us before the demonstration at the Esquire Lounge, corner of Walnut University, at 1 p.m. for lunch before the 2 o'clock demo. That's today, 2 o'clock on the corner of Neal and Main Street in downtown Champaign.
All right, Dave.
Yes.
I have the 1 minute and 26 second official trailer for Citizen Four queued up on the Aux channel.
Okay.
Right now.
Let's try it.
Okay. Don't forget to shut the mics off.
Okay.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Laura. At this stage, I can offer nothing more than my word. I am a senior government employee in the intelligence community. I hope you understand that contacting you is extremely high risk. For now, know that every border you cross, every purchase you make, every call you dial, every cell phone tower you pass, friend you keep, site you visit, and subject line you type is in the hands of a system whose reach is unlimited, but whose safeguards are not. In the end, if you publish the source material, I will likely be immediately implicated. I ask only that you ensure this information makes it home to the American public. Thank you, and be careful. Citizen 4.
Sorry, I don't know anything about you.
Okay, I work for,
Sorry, I don't know your name.
Oh, sorry. My name is Edward Snowden. I go by Ed. Edward Joseph Snowden's the full name.
Okay, that was a trailer for Citizen 4. Thanks for finding that, Bill. That was a pretty eerie trailer.
Well, thanks to Al Gore for inventing the internet so I could do that.
Al Gore invented the internet?
Yeah, well, where did that ever that come old from? One. Yes.
Where did
right
that
after,
ever come from?
Right after Ralph Nader stole before Ralph Nader stole the election from him and...
Oh, please. That's, you know what?
And other political mythology.
We need to have a whole program on that. I think that's a very important topic that's went down the memory hole of what really transpired in that November 2000 election. Because frankly, George Bush should never have been allowed to take the White House, to be allowed to enter the White House. I mean, there should have been another election in Florida. In any real democracy, there would have been, or at the very least,
the trade
unions and the other opposition groups and the opposition party, yeah, the Democratic Party is supposed to be an opposition party in a real democracy. If it was an opposition party, they would have basically called for shutting down the country until there was another election in Florida. But did that happen? No.
Well, yeah, and Al Gore didn't even, you know, push it as far as, you know, he should have, much less as far as he could have.
Indeed.
And, you know, it's just ridiculous. And what is it, like 2 years later, newspapers come out. Well, yeah, he should have won.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, what we have in the United States, and this has probably happened since the, the post-war era when the militarism took over, and you can look to writers like Peter Dale Scott for this stuff, and it's what he calls the deep state,
mm-hmm.
where it gets to the point where it doesn't really matter who the president is anymore,
mm-hmm.
because there's groups, factions, organizations, institutions that are there long after each president's term,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in between terms. And that's something else too, Dave, when you're talking about parties and unions and stuff. We need to not just have educational efforts every election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
What there has to be going on is a continuing education of the American people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this, I know that several years ago, and I think you were probably skeptical of this, and a lot of people were.
Mm-hmm.
There was a report done at the AFL-CIO that came out and said they needed to be doing more public relations.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't skeptical of that.
Oh, okay, because a lot of people are like, oh, man, public relations. And, of course, we do criticize public relations a lot, but mm-hmm. because it's always used against us.
Yes.
And we don't have people like the AFL-CIO out running constant informational advertising,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they should be doing it on the news channels. That's how come you'll see, if you're watching CNN or something, you'll see commercials from people you're not going to buy a fighter plane from because they're just trying to influence, you know.
Sure, sure. Oh, you're absolutely right. Listen, our caller is scheduled to call in here, and I think between now and then we're going to take another quick music break. Oh, there he is. Never mind. Here we go. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Fran Tobin from the Alliance for Community Service.
Hi, Fran. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Good, good. Well, listen, I wanted you to call in because, you know, I just found out about this, what happened with this campaign against Maximus, just to think about, not too long ago. I mean, I don't think it was quite a year ago. And I just wanted you to call in and kind of talk a little bit about what happened. And since then, I just got some information yesterday showing that Maximus, this corporation that was hired by the state of Illinois, is all over the place. I mean, they just got awarded a huge contract out in California to manage their workman's comp system. I mean, this company is like some kind of science fiction monster that has tentacles everywhere. So with that said, you want to go ahead and talk a little bit about the Maximus campaign that you were involved with?
Sure. And as you said, Maximus is all over the place. They're in another example. They're certainly not the only one, but they're one of these examples of a mega corporation that basically gets a few people rich by sucking money out of the public sector for private purposes. And their whole model and their whole approach is basically to convince public bodies, local governments, especially state governments, that have huge administrative jobs to handle things like public services, public aid, you know, unemployment, et cetera.
Fran, can I stop you for just a second? Are you on speakerphone?
I'm not. But let me see if I can switch over to a different.
Yeah, because there's considerable echo there, and I was wondering if there's some way we could correct that.
I'm in a room that's a little bit echoey. Is that a little bit better?
That's a little better. Yes. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. So Maximus is just a great example of, you know, corporate malfeasance, sucking resources out of the public sector, allegedly for public good, but really for private gain. And in the case of Illinois, even though Maximus is a national company, they had bad experiences many other places. But despite their history, so for example, a bunch of years ago, the state of Wisconsin cited them for all kinds of improper billing. Maximus has a long history, as a lot of these companies do, of, you know, overbilling and improperly billing the public so they can pad their bottom line. In 2007, Maximus actually had to pay a $30 million fine because of overbilling for these various public contracts. So even though there's all this bad experiences, you know, they sold their services to the state of Illinois on the theory that, gee, the state of Illinois is broke. All these states are allegedly broke. I would say the states aren't really broke, that the system has been broken, but that's another conversation. So they're saying that you know, the state's broke, so, gee, we can come in and do all this work for less. Well, here's the problem. It just as a part of the problem. So Maximus makes his claim based on a few things. First, the problem in the first place of, in the case of Medicaid, which was one of the pieces of what Maximus was doing and is still doing in Illinois. And they have other contracts as well. Maximus has their tentacles all over the place. So they were saying that the Medicaid list, which is, you know, a couple million people in Illinois, depend on Medicaid to get their health care. And very important, obviously. So because the state has been underfunding the Department of Human Services for years, this is a bipartisan problem. Both Democrat and Republican administrations have been underfunding and understaffing the Department of Human Services, which has to actually administer the process of Medicaid applications and renewals, et cetera. So there aren't nearly enough people. So the state actually has fewer government employees per population than almost any other state in the country. And there just aren't enough people to do the work. So, of course, services decline. The state's been closing offices all around the state of human services. And so in that context, Maximus steps in and says, gee, the state, have been screwing up the system. Therefore, there's a longer and longer backlog of people who are supposed to be evaluated for their eligibility for Medicaid. Now, if the state had been properly administering their own program, of course, this backlog wouldn't have happened. But this is so it starts with this claim. Then Maximus says, you pay us $76 million, and, you know, we'll clean it up for you, and in the process, we'll find all this rampant fraud. And there's so much fraud, they say, with no evidence, that we'll actually save the state $300 million by pocketing $76
million. Mm-hmm.
So that's the theory.
Okay.
Which is kind of the way they sell all these privatization contracts, right?
Correct.
Well, if you do a word search for the word Maximus, the first thing that pops up is for their website, and in big letters it says, helping government serve the people.
Oh.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think of a better word, screwing them. Okay, go ahead.
Get more from Maximus. 13,000 plus strong and a shared passion for innovation. Our global team offers real world insights and information that shed new light.
Global?
Blah, blah.
Is this company an international company?
I'm not aware of what they might do outside of the U.S. borders.
Okay.
They certainly are all over the country,
mm-hmm.
Bombing onto pieces of public funding wherever they can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're great with these words like innovation and
yes.
technology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're going to streamline systems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's
it's
how
a new paradigm.
That's right. A new paradigm. In Illinois, their innovation was like this. No one's ever thought of this before. So instead of paying, this was their innovation, instead of paying properly trained caseworkers
mm-hmm.
who know the law,
mm-hmm.
who know how to administer Medicaid, who know what the eligibility requirements are, instead of doing that, what we will do, we Maximus, is we'll hire completely untrained and uninformed people at minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
We will give them basically no training,
mm-hmm.
and we'll tell them, we the bosses, will tell the frontline workers to cancel everybody.
Yeah.
That's the innovation.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant strategy.
For them.
Yeah, this sounds real similar. I listened to a podcast from Bristol, England. And, you know, they had the National Health Service is supposed to be like the big jewel of, you know, Britain's society, basically. And, they've had privatization as real similar to this, and they're talking all the time about how basically this company's just there to say no.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah, it's backdoor privatization, you know, and that's the thing is that, you know, of course they try to always work in the shadows, you know, to.
Well, and then people will be, I'm not getting any services, you know, well maybe we don't need this National Health Service and I could go out and buy, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you see where
that agenda is going. Undermines the entire system.
Sure. So, what's interesting though, so you guys asked me, union activists, you did something really innovative. You want to tell the listeners what you guys did to sort of fight back against Maximus?
Well, this started a little bit before the Maximus fight,
okay.
Where there were all these attacks on human services,
mm-hmm.
and generally public sector and the public good. So some of the members of AFSCME, who are the workers, the frontline workers, not the policymakers,
mm-hmm.
the frontline workers in the Department of Human Services. So these are the folks that actually sit across the table with real people, with consumers, and, you know, deal with their issues and, you know, process Medicaid and food stamp applications and all that stuff. So these folks realized that these attacks were coming, that they were getting worse, and that they needed to build community partnerships and actually have an across-the-table alliance. So a year ago, starting with actually some of the closures of the human services offices, they closed about 30 offices around the state, including several in Chicago, all around the state, which obviously made services worse for people that actually need them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also part of the bigger picture of austerity, saying, all right, we have to slash and close everything. You know, if we slash and burn enough, gee, we're going to somehow improve services. Same as with our mayor up in Chicago, Mayor Emanuel, is slashing mental health centers. And
mm-hmm. Well, I mean, look, he was complicit in NAFTA, and I'm sure when the TPP, whatever this thing is, first came up and was born, he was probably pushing that to Obama, too. Rahm Emanuel's just one of these neoliberal jerks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
so part of that whole stem. So the idea was that some of the AFSCME members at the grassroots, at the rank and file level, started to work with the consumer, the people across the table, and reached out to some of the community groups whose members are, you know, Medicaid beneficiaries and food stamps, folks who depend on food stamps. And so started building this alliance, and that's where the Alliance for Community Services came from. And as the other pieces of privatization, the contract with Maximus, some other closures, the state has been restructuring the staffing. One of those, you know, seemingly, minuscule kind of policy changes that has a huge effect on quality of services. So in a bunch of offices, they've started the system where instead of having a caseworker, you have an assembly line. So instead of a caseworker assigned to people, they're assigned to tasks. And so it's, you know, total disaster for people who are from the community. And it's obviously degrading to the work. So it's deprofessionalizing the work of the public workers. And so the idea was that by teaming up in this alliance, we can have a greater impact on actually preserving and improving the quality of services. So the fight around Maximus happened in a couple of different tracks. So through the union, and in particular led by, you know, the state council, Council 31, there were grievances filed under the contract. But the important thing to remember in all these labor community fights is that, you know, the contract technically doesn't require good services. You can't file a grievance over, well, you're actually not serving people well. You can file a grievance over, you're privatizing my job improperly, or you're redefining my job description without negotiation. I mean, those are terms of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of the issue that obviously happens in labor fights all the time, where, you know, the powers that be try to reduce the scope of what's within the realm officially of what the union can fight for. So the union filed a grievance and brought it to arbitration, saying that the state improperly hired Maximus, and they were supported. They were correct. They won that grievance. They won the arbitration. On the other hand, though, the bigger and broader fight was about quality of service. So through the alliance, both the workers and the consumers were saying, you're not only hurting the workers in this privatization process, you're actually hurting the community.
Mm-hmm.
Tens of thousands of people, at least, lost their Medicaid coverage, even though they're eligible. And of course, there's a racial overtone to all of this, where Medicaid is always being under attack, and the accusation is there are all these folks out there who are getting Medicaid that don't deserve it. Maximus, through their great innovation, canceled over 100,000 cases. At least 30% of those cases were wrongfully canceled at the first cut. So when they were reviewed by some of the state workers, at least 30% of those were found to have been wrongfully canceled.
So one in three, basically, okay.
Right. So they're claiming that they're saving all this money because of fraud,
mm-hmm.
but much of the fraud they're finding, even at the first glance,
mm-hmm.
was not fraud. It was just a mistake by Maximus.
Mm-hmm.
It's not surprising, given that Maximus' innovation was to hire and not train people at minimum wage,
mm-hmm.
and basically tell them to cancel. So I've, through the alliance, you know, we've actually worked with and talked to people that worked for for Maximus on this program for a while. And they said very clearly, you know, their bosses didn't train them. Their bosses didn't understand the Medicaid rules. So even the people in charge of Medicaid eligibility testing didn't know what the rules were.
Wow.
How are they supposed to train people to check whether or not someone's eligible? And if there was any doubt, cancel them. So huge. Tens of thousands of people found out that their medical card was canceled by going to the doctor.
Oh,
my
gosh.
They show up with their kid and say, they say, sorry, you've been canceled. And these are people who are eligible. So for starters, there was this huge impact on consumers, which required a different kind of approach, which was really a community organizing approach. So the workers, along with the consumers, were reaching out to community groups around this. And that was part of what the innovation of the Alliance was.
Okay.
The other piece of this whole picture is that even though, so part of Maximus's innovation was this kind of automated center of technology mailing. So here's what they do. They send out, you know, a million pieces of mail. Not quite a million, but large number of pieces of mail. And some of it bounces. And so if it bounces, people are automatically canceled. Now, I live in a community that's very mixed income. And people in my neighborhood routinely have mail that's correctly addressed to them bounce because there's a problem with their mailbox. Or there's a, you know, visiting letter carrier that doesn't know their route or some kind of problem. So out of hundreds of thousands of pieces of mail, some of those correctly addressed pieces are going to bounce. But according to Maximus, that must mean that the person's ineligible. If people don't respond, so if you don't respond in a certain period of time, then you're automatically canceled. And they count that as, well, obviously it's somebody who is defrauding the system, but Maximus is claiming that they should be canceled. So these are folks who are now pouring back into the offices. They were already understaffed. And now these workers who are already overloaded are spending their days reinstating people that shouldn't have been canceled in the first place. So Maximus gets paid $76 million, which is more than it would have cost to actually do all this work if they had used public employees, by the way.
Yeah, I saw some statistic that by, as a result of this lawsuit, that by getting Maximus, you know, kicked out of there and state employees, AFSCME members hired back in, that it actually not only is going to improve service for people who qualify for Medicare, but it's going to actually save the state of Illinois $18 million.
That's right. So according to running through the numbers indicated that the Maximus contract actually cost $16 to $18 million more than had they hired and trained actual caseworkers who knew the system and could provide better services to do the same work.
It's amazing that this company keeps getting these contracts, these different state entities around the country, considering their documented history of shoddy work. It seems like they've got some very influential backers that are legislators, you know, both at the state and I guess national level. And I guess there was a big case of this happening in New York State a few years ago, in which it was ex-Mayor Giuliani was involved up to his up to his neck with Maximus, and then now I just found out that Maximus has got the contract in the state of California to handle workman comp cases, which I've heard that if you try to appeal the decision, and that basically you can't sue them, that they basically set up this like protective barrier to protect Maximus from any wrongful actions that they do to their clients. Are you familiar with any of this, or?
I'm not familiar with the California situation, but I'm definitely familiar with how these contracts are geared to make sure that they ensure profits for the private company, but they don't protect consumers or taxpayers. Like typically, you know, highways have been privatized and...
Parking meters in Chicago.
Oh man, that is...
And these contracts are written so that if anything happens, the private contractor gets reimbursed.
That's right. So, if people quit driving cars in Chicago, they'll still get paid, right?
Right. In Indiana, they privatized one of the tollways, and this was again, you know, Maximus has contracts in Indiana as well. There was a flood, which meant that the tollways had to be closed for a day and a half. And so the taxpayers had to pay the private companies to make up for what would have been the toll.
Wow.
So nobody was driving the toll.
I was just wondering something else.
They structure these deals so that they're, many of them actually go bankrupt after 10 or 15 years on a 30 or 50 or 75 year contract. But all the bondholders that financed it in the first place, which then brings it back to Wall Street financiers, they all get made whole, but services are gone, and
the municipality is stuck with the bill to pay them back.
Wow. Well, I was wondering, do you have a chance to run on that or drive on that Indiana toll road very often? I was just wondering if
they're, very often.
I was just wondering if they still maintain it as well, or. Of course, this is getting far from our show here, but I would like to look at this sometime. Are they subject to prevailing wage laws when it comes to getting work done on these, you know, roads? But that's probably for another show. As a matter of fact, I mentioned listening to a radio show from Bristol, England. They're complaining about this sort of thing. And according to the Maximus website, they do operate in England and in the health fields.
Oh,
so
basically they're go ahead. I'm sorry.
This issue of how do they get away with this kind of stuff? And let me just mention, for starters, two names.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Montoni.
Okay.
He's the CEO of Maximus.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy pocketed $16 million over a 4-year period, basically for running welfare programs.
Okay.
Say he was the highest paid state worker or welfare administrator in the country.
Wow.
So with the $16 million, you can buy a lot of influence.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that seems to be a huge fan of Maximus is Patty Bellock. She's a state rep in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually running around screaming, "How dare people criticize Maximus? Look at the great work they're doing. They're doing exactly what we need to have happen under the SMART Act, which they pushed, which was intended to cut Medicaid."
Mm-hmm.
That was part of the privatization, which led to Maximus taking on this job. But she completely ignored the fact that, again, tens of thousands of eligible people were being denied health care in order to profit Maximus. And yet Patty Bellock, who is rumored to be the new, likely new secretary of the Department of Human Services, would rather shovel more money into the pockets of Richard Montoni than make sure that her own constituents get health care that they deserve.
Yes. Where is she from? What district is she from, or what area?
It's northern, kind of northern Illinois. I forget her district exactly.
Okay.
It's outside of Cook County.
Okay. All right. So out by DeKalb or somewhere out there, sort of. Okay. Okay.
Well, as in addition to Montoni's $16,194,847 made between 2008 and 2012, the other top executives at Maximus received a total compensation of another $41,808,585.
And this is all coming out of our public funds.
Well, $76 million of it apparently came from Illinois.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
That's bad, huh?
Yeah. Well, Fran, listen, we just ran out of time, but I want to thank you for calling in. And I tell you what, this is a story more and more people need to hear about. You know, privatization, seems to be the new, offensive, if you will, against, the public good and, working people in general. And I think, you know, we need to, expose this as much as possible, both the actions as well as the players. And also, it's also equally good to hear about innovative, organizing, fight back tactics like, you guys did. As far as organizing caseworkers and actual recipients, you know, service, I guess you'd call them clients or whatever. So I'm really glad you called in and told us about this and everything. And, you know, keep me updated on this, you know, as you come into more of this, because I'd love to, you know, give updates to the listeners as well.
Sounds great. Thanks, you guys, for doing what you do.
Okay, thank you very much. Take care.
Bye.
Goodbye. Okay, that was Fran Tobin. He's with the he's a union activist and organizer with the AFSCME Union, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees here in Illinois, and he was just talking about the privatization of the Medicaid system here for a while that cost the taxpayers more money, and also did a very shoddy job that cut people off of Medicaid that qualified, and hiring minimum wage workers that didn't know what they were doing. Displacing well-trained union members that have been doing this work for years, sometimes decades. So anyway, I want to thank him again for calling in. So we're going to take a quick music break. This is Paul Kottheimer doing a little labor-related song, and then Bill and I are going to come back, and we're going to talk about some of the things that have happened in this last year in 2014. So you're listening to the World Labor Hour on Lister Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
TV preachers come on every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked how about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on pay. You'll get high in the sky when you die. That's a lie. And the starvation army leads you. And they sing and they clap and they pray till they get all your coin on the drum. Then they tell you when you're on the bum. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get high in the sky when you die. That's a lie. And if you work for the good things in life, they will tell you to stop all the strife. Be a sheep for your boss, if they say, or to hell you are sure on your way. Working folk of all countries unite. Side by side, we for freedom will fight. Till the world and its wealth we have in. To them grafters, we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by when you learn how to cook and to fry. Chop some wood, it'll do you good. And you will eat in the street, you will eat in the street, you will eat in the street by and by.
Okay, that was local performer Paul and songwriter Paul Kottheimer doing a rendition of Preacher and a Slave, old labor song and everything. So anyway,
it's an old IWW song,
indeed,
wasn't it?
Indeed.
The Little Red Songbook.
Yep.
And by the way, Paul was wasn't into labor stuff too much until several, many, many years ago. We booked him with to open for Ann Feeney, and
that's
also
right.
Tom doing poetry.
Yeah.
And after that, Paul, I don't know if it was an influence. I hope it was.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a lot of really good political work.
Yeah,
over Paul's the last year. Well, I'll be playing him more.
Yeah, indeed. Know? Paul's a member of the ASME Union too, by the way, at the University of Illinois. Yeah,
he's a librarian, I believe.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very good. Excellent musician, man.
Indeed. And this song came off this one album he made called CD, I should say, Serious Folking Music.
I really like that one.
Yeah,
and it's very environmentally friendly package too.
Indeed. And there's some great songs on here, like he does a great song in homage to the catastrophe of Hurricane Katrina, mm-hmm. called Trouble the Water. He also does some good other songs like Sweatshop Girls, Radical Cheerleader, Direct Action, Fertilizer Department, which is another IWW song, and What Solidarity Means to Me, which is kind of a interesting song in a sense that he kind of it's a little bit of a critique of union leadership in some ways, how it's kind of lost its vision a little bit.
Well, I mean, Dave, was there ever actually a golden era? Maybe the Knights of Labor?
Well, IWW, and in the 19...
Well, I mean, overall.
Yeah, 1930s. I mean,
because the IWW had to deal with the AFL.
Yeah.
AF of L,
but
excuse me.
In the 1930s, I mean, look, all the sit-down strikes, the UAW, the UE, I mean, that was probably the golden age.
Well, talking about, like leadership and...
Well, there was some good leadership back then. Yeah. I mean, like you've said many times before in the air, Bill, back in the 20s, 30s, and into the 40s, you mentioned the name John L. Lewis, and everybody knew who you're talking about.
Right. He was on the level of Clark Gable, FDR, anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But here's something.
Mention the name, Dick Trumka amongst union members.
No, nobody's ever heard of Richard Trumka. But here's something. One time me and Larry Solomon, who was former president of the UAW local Indicator,
yes,
during
mm-hmm.
the Staley struggles, and mm-hmm. also the Firestone.
The War Zone, yes.
All the struggles back then. Me and him was at a used bookstore here in Champaign
mm-hmm.
one day, and we were looking through some books, and I found this big red book, and it was a study done by, I can't remember their names, but they were well-known labor, the U of I, like right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to fake the town, but they called it Soy City, and it was obvious they were talking about Decatur. And one of the things they said in there was, I should have bought this book. One of the things they said was, well, the laborers in Decatur are coming back strong since their business agent got out of prison. And you know
that's
the history of my local. And
yeah, that's pretty funny. We've talked about that many times before about how we've had, we kind of went from, corporate unionism in this country, and then to sort of a lot of unions had like a sort of a corrupt strongman type of union like say Jimmy Hoffa, the Teamsters, and now we've come into this era of corporate unionism, which is so bad that it actually makes the strongman corrupt unions of the past actually look good.
Strongman had to produce some.
Yes.
Now these guys, I don't know. I mean, really, the kind of people that get in, they just seem a lot different, They're not like your sort of butt kicker BAs that you used to have.
No.
Like, say, maybe Jack Peterson.
Yeah. And for all his faults, Gene Johnson, he did police the work, and he got good contracts.
And he organized a lot of people at the University of Illinois, too.
Yeah, and other places. Mm-hmm.
And I tell you now, the people that run the laborers, they're like, I don't want to have to deal with those people.
Mm-hmm.
All they want to deal with is the construction side.
Yeah, indeed. Well, listen, I just wanted to, since it's kind of a year-end program, I got this off of In These Times, and it's basically the 9 most important victories for workers in 2014. I just wanted to kind of run them down for people out there. I guess number 1 on the list was Northwestern University athletes hold a union vote. And I remember we definitely covered that on the show a while back, and basically the reason they wanted to unionize was not for money, but for conditions, I guess. Anyway, that was an interesting case. Then the court rules that FedEx drivers are employees and not independent contractors.
Yes.
That was a victory. The Fight for 15 goes international. In its third year as a national movement of low-wage workers demanding $15 an hour and a union, the Fight for 15 dug in its heels. And I'm trying to see where they went international here. I wasn't
Doesn't really make any sense international.
Yeah, unless they were talking about Canada. It'd be real nice if they're talking about Mexico, of course, because man, $15 an hour minimum wage there would really boost the standard of living in Mexico. Anyway, NLRB, National Labor Relations Boards, give new rights to unions. Some of those...
Wait a minute, Dave.
Yes.
We might want to just call those privileges because the next administration can take them away.
Well, that's true.
You know, just as easy. They're not even legislated.
Yes, that's true. These are rulings. One of them was that they ruled that employees can use company email for union activity. It also requires that employers turn over any employee email addresses and telephone numbers it possesses during a union election.
Really?
Yes.
Because that's really the tough thing, man, is
indeed.
To learn how to contact people.
Yes. The other one here.
Actually, that quite as often is used against the unions because the organizers have to come and knock on your door.
Yes.
Because somebody told them that you work at the place. And I've seen, in fact, in BMET, at the Simcoe plant,
mm-hmm.
the guy that ran that plant was accusing the laborers from Tuscola, the old Tuscola local, of intimidating his employees. And he had the cop come and sit out there.
Really?
Yeah, in front of their plant. And then my dad was mayor, and he said, no, you're not going to do that.
Well, good for him. Okay, the other one is Seattle passes a $15 minimum wage. In last year's list, we gave a shout-out to Kushama Sawant, who won a city council seat in Seattle on a socialist ticket with a $15 an hour minimum wage as the pillar of her platform. And barely 6 months after she took office, her city passed such a wage, making Seattle the first major U.S. city to raise the bar for its lowest-paid workers to $15
an hour. However,
there's some problems. It's a little more problematic.
It's watered down, to say the least.
Yes.
And they will not be the $15 an hour for how many years?
It's going to be a few years. Yeah, I think three or four.
Yeah, and then it'll be worth $7.25.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and then another one here, New Orleans goes union. I guess after a successful card check in September, the Teamsters and Unite Here was able to win election of 900 employees of Harrah's Hotel and Casino in New Orleans, doubling the number of union members in the city's tourism industry. New Orleans, right after Hurricane Katrina, one of the first things that was done by the Bush administration was to completely privatize New Orleans public school system, where it's all charter schools, and completely disaffiliated all these teachers that were members. Some have been teaching for decades, members of the International Federation of Teachers or the National Education Association. It was done with a stroke of a pen. I mean, it was not the choice of the community, the parents, or the students. Okay, number seven: American Airlines, JetBlue, and Virgin American workers unionize. Okay, I missed that. When I didn't hear
poor
about that.
Richard Branson.
And number eight here, San Francisco's Retail Workers Bill of Rights, I guess, was passed. And what I guess that entails is that the new Retail Workers Bill of Rights, the rules will require retail chains that have 11 or more locations across the country and employ 20 or more people in San Francisco to provide advance notice of schedules, improve the treatment of part-time employees, and give current workers the opportunity to take on more hours before hiring new people. Employers will also have to give their workers at least 2 weeks advance notice of their schedules. And if they fail to do so, they'll have to give these workers additional predictability pay. Workers will also get paid if they're required to be on call, but their shifts are canceled. And employers will have to give part-time employees the same starting wage as those working full-time in the same position and access to the same benefits. And lastly, number nine, Chattanooga Volkswagen workers won a minority union representation, which we've covered that story here. And as we kind of talked about
it. I think that's an interesting concept, and that's the way things work in France. And actually, in France, they have a lower union density than the United States, I believe. Mm-mm. Yes, they do, Dave. They do have a very low union density, but the thing is, when the unions want to do something, people will do it.
Yeah.
Even non-union people. I'm pretty sure I can look that up for,
sometime before the next show, for sure, because I'm doubting that. From what I know, the United States has the lowest union density of any industrialized, advanced country. But anyway, this UAW, Volkswagen, thing was, considered a big discipline. Sort of a half victory.
In membership terms, the French trade union movement is one of the weakest in Europe, with only 8% of employees in unions.
No kidding.
Yeah, but they can get a huge number of the country behind them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have to have a huge you know, membership, I guess. But I mean, if they call for something, millions of people that aren't even union, that aren't union members. I mean, business owners will close up shops, you know, sorry. But
no, that's good. I'm glad you, you know, enlightened me on that.
But see, they do, but they have the minority union. Like you could work in a place where there might be three unions representing different, I mean, the same worker. Right. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. And so anyway, it was considered a half victory, this thing of Volkswagen, because UAW didn't get exclusive bargaining rights.
I think it's an interesting,
probably a good thing,
a new model. I mean, you know, it gets the union in somewhere anyway.
Well, not only that, but you know, the United Auto Workers used to be a great Democratic and militant union. I mean, you know, that's, they're one of the big success stories of the 1930s. But in recent years, they've become, less and less Democratic, negotiating, you know, sweetheart deal contracts.
Well, I mean, they started that in the 1980s, man, with the onslaught of the Japanese car makers.
Well, but, you know, it's an interesting kind of parallel between the UAW strategy here on this side of the border and the Canadian auto workers, which had a much more militant stance and basically got more for their members.
You know that big American-looking truck I got, that Ford F-150?
Yes.
It's imported.
From Canada?
From Windsor, Ontario.
Okay. Across the river from Detroit. But no, I think, you know what? I think, this is a good thing because I'll tell you what, if nothing else, I think, you know, that some other unions should try to get representation in there. And I think this is be a good little opportunity for, to make some of these unions to be a little bit more, listen to their members a little bit more and actually kind of compete to see who's going to better represent the members. Because what we've been seeing for all too long is these unions becoming more and more corporatized and they're not concerned about what their members think, you know, and a lot of times, you know, they'll seem like the only thing they're concerned about is their salaries, perks, and the flow of dues money and whatever the bosses want. So I think this is an interesting little development, and I think this is actually a good thing that this happened as far as this minority union at this point and Volkswagen down
in
Chattanooga.
Yeah, well, you know, Dave, why I think that the anarcho-syndicalism never did take a really good grip in the United States. Or even socialism, is because I think that there's really not a very large segment of the American working class that wants to control things.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, see, like our union leaders, I don't think they would really want to try and run a business or try and actually control the industries that they work in. They don't want the responsibility.
Well, historically, Bill, I mean, especially in the building trades, believe it or not, back in the 1880s, 90s, into the first part of the 1900s, a lot of your unionship leadership and the union members.
Well, yeah, there was a big cooperative movement at that time.
Were anarchists.
Yeah, but that's all gone. That's what I'm saying. It's not
all gone
here
now. Right.
Yeah.
But they ultimately, what their goal was back then, that basically contract negotiations was mainly a means to an end, that they ultimately wanted to completely do away with the contractors.
Right.
And that the union and its members would basically go directly to the customers to do the work.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a case in Boston.
And actually managed the workplace themselves democratically.
Correct. Back in the, right after World War I, I guess, Boston area, building trades, I guess the contractors came and said, well, you know, the war's over and demand's down, inflation's up, and we expect you to take a 10% wage cut across the board. Well, what they did, what the reaction of the building trades was, is they put out ads in all the local newspapers, Boston Herald and the others, saying direct craftsman to customer quality construction work.
Yeah. Well, see, I bring that.
Let me finish the story. Yeah. And within, I guess, within a matter of hours after these ads went out in the local newspapers, the contractors were calling the building trades, please come back to the negotiating table. And in the end, after just a short, I guess, day of negotiation, all the building trade workers didn't take a 10% pay cut. They actually got a 10% pay increase. So, I mean, I think there's a big lesson to be learned from that.
Well, yeah, Dave, I mean, I'd say like, you know, 20, 25 years ago, before I really was aware of the IWW or heard of anarcho-syndicalism or anything like that, you know, I'd be working on these construction jobs on there, and we got, you know, our bosses are the union members, and quite often, the contractors are union members, you know? And I'd talk to people and I'd say, hey, look, man, you know, we know how to do this work And we could just, why don't we just get together and rent equipment and the unions just do it. And be, oh no, that's going to be, antitrust or something, you know. And
but
they would just blow their minds to
and
think
why do you,
of that.
Well, yeah, why do you think that is? I mean, how many years of corporate propaganda?
That's what I'm saying, Dave. Is I'm saying, yeah, back then before Edward Bernays and such, you had, you know, a lot of your working class did want to actually run their own lives and run things. Now it's, you know, kind of not like that, you know.
Well, it's all about where you get your information. Remember back then too, it was typical for any given large city to have not one, but sometimes half a dozen or more
different languages,
labor newspapers, you know.
You know.
Yeah, and then Chicago, radio station Chicago?
WCFL.
Yes, that was the first radio station in Chicago, and it was owned by the Chicago Federation of Labor, and it was one of the most innovative radio stations, you know, in Chicago.
Oh, yeah,
at the time,
I read a history of it. I can't remember the name of the book, but, and when it started out, it was much like they would have labor education shows.
Yep.
It was all oriented towards labor culture. But as time went on, I mean, by the time that we were tuning it in say, the 1960s,
70s,
it was running baseball games and top 40 music.
Yep.
You know?
And that's the thing, and that's one of the things we've talked about before, is that organized labor, I mean, they should have had a nationwide cable television network decades ago. I remember reading an article in Mother Jones magazine back in 1981 advocating for a national newspaper to be financed by the AFL-CIO. It's like, you know, this is something I think it's more than dropping the ball on it. I think this is intentional.
Here's one. You know David Swanson?
Yes.
You've heard of David Swanson, well-known activist.
Yes.
Downing Street website, all that has been very effective in a lot of ways. Over 10 years ago, I interviewed him because he was director of the International Labor Communications Association.
Okay.
Now, see, we would not be eligible to join that because the people in that organization are the people who put out the official union house organs.
Ah,
You know, and I was talking to him and I was thinking, man, this guy, he's sharp, he's young. This could be a really good thing. And I think he was only in there for about a year and, you know, they got some regular, the next guy I talked to over Katrina a few years later, he didn't even know what the prevailing wage was.
Oh wow.
As a concept, because that's why I called him, because everybody in the media was saying that the prevailing wage then was $9 an hour. And I could tell just from listening to this guy, he was older and, you know, he just was going to be doing basically what, you know, all the old apparatchiks want done.
Mm-hmm. And that may be why this David Swanson was replaced. You know?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking too.
Yeah, because as we've talked about before, unfortunately, you know, unions, national unions have become part of the system. And unfortunately, they've lost contact with what their members want. And they have gotten too cozy with the Democratic Party in general and with a lot of these politicians and corporate heads. And, you know, it's almost like Animal Farm. You know,
well, you know, back in the days we were talking about in the late 1900 or late 1800s and such, there's a lot more people who wanted the whole pie.
Yeah.
Now, and they wanted the table.
Yeah.
Now it's, you know, the piece of the pie and the seat at the table.
Or even just the crumbs, you know. Yeah.
The crumbs next to the seat at the table.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And this is what, you know, how much do they teach about unionism in apprenticeship classes? You know, we've talked about that in the program.
Well, how
before.
Much do you learn about it in school?
Indeed.
In the United States, in Illinois, at least it used to be, there was a law where you have to do so much labor education, and most of your teachers
are union members.
And people walk out, they don't know anything about unions at all.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, we've went a little bit in overtime here, I brought so much more, like Project Censor's top 25 censored stories of 2014, some other topics, but you know, we just ran out of time. So I'm sorry, we had that occasionally happen here. So you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. We're going to end with a little Tom Morello, and stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And until next week, be safe. Power to the people. Take care.